share some info. Well, I guess that's what networking is all about.
Right.
But the old way, well, the way that I knew.
And we also have a...
In person, yeah.
We also have a show coming up in Kelowna.
In Kelowna, you guys are going to Kelowna.
Yeah,
I'm so glad.
We're going out into the sticks. That's fun. And that's going to be cool, too. It's put on by the Cavernous. They're local.
Oh, yes. You guys were
awesome.
There with them last time I saw
yes.
you guys at the...
At Bullies,
actually.
We were playing.
That's awesome.
It's going to be at Unleashed Brewing... October 24th, Saturday, October 24th. There's two floors. I think the bottom floor is going to be rock bands.
Nice.
So it's like down the Lees, Growlix, Sweet Beast is going to be on the rock stage. And then for electronic stuff, that's going to be upstairs, and that's the Cavernous, Liminal, and us.
That is pretty awesome, guys. Yeah. You guys are doing it. It's happening, eh? It's always that little bit, eh? What do you guys think about Mexico, eh? Mexico.
You know
opens
what?
Their doors to CJSF 90.1 FM.
We're all for Mexico, man. I would go down there in a heartbeat.
Yeah, man, it's
like
happening.
Mexico City, listen, the food, the ladies, the love. I mean, come on. What's not to love about Mexico?
Speaking of ladies and love, let's go with Voodoo Doll, with Kawama, who's going to be playing this tomorrow, actually, at the Waldorf Hotel. Come and say hi. Come on, take some pictures with us. We're going to be stopping saying hi. And so, Voodoo Doll Kawama. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Open Mic Show here with Humanoid No More, or Frank Connor from Studio Uno, and all the crew and staff from CJSF 90.1 FM. Till the next one.
Inside of what we call the fungal hyphae, so those are the long tubes of fungi. So molecular motors are very small motors that move nutrients around. And you can see when you study these flows, you can see how nutrients kind of start to attach to almost to the sides of the wall and move in different directions. So we know that molecular motors play a role, moving in different directions at the same time. We also think that there's a very, very important contribution of pressure-driven flows. And that's really what we're trying to understand now, is that the cytoplasmic contents inside these networks, that liquid, is under a lot of pressure. And we think that the fungi might be able to change the direction of those flows by changing the pressure inside those tubes.
I mean, not to get too scientific, but we're talking about pressure gradients. So, you know, what one segment of the hyphus would be, you know, high pressure, and another would low pressure, and things flow from high to low pressure. How do they generate pressure gradients?
Yeah, that's exactly. These are all the kinds of questions that we're trying to answer in our group, is how these pressure gradients are generated. We know that water moves through these networks, that fungi can actually take up water and give it to the host plant. And so that's one way that we know pressure is building up, is when water enters into the hyphae. At the same time, we know that carbon is being loaded from the plant roots into the hyphae, and that can change pressure gradients. You have to remember, these are microscopic rivers of nutrients, and they're flowing really fast. So inside a fungal network, it would feel like you are moving about 50 kilometers an hour, 30 to 50 kilometers an hour. But that's just the average speed. They can get up to speeds that are really, really quite high. So we talk about speeds of about 100 microns per second, right? It's hard to imagine what it's like to be inside a fungal network. But basically, it feels like you're moving inside a pretty steady moving car, I would say.
Do you want to turn on your laptop and show me some of these things? And I'm curious, how do you actually observe this? How do you map fungal networks, and how do you actually observe these flows? I presume you're following them in the lab, in vitro, not in vivo.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just getting up some of the videos now. Those are two very different questions, and we study them on very different scales. And I think that's what makes this initiative so exciting, is that we can study these kinds of dynamics on a micron scale, at an incredibly small scale, and bring these fungal networks in symbiosis with plant roots actually into the lab and start to understand and actually quantify how fast individual particles are moving in these flows. That's an incredibly refined scale. At the same time, we're part of this larger movement where we're trying to map the biodiversity of these fungal networks across the globe. So on the one hand, we're at the scale of microns, and at the other, we're at the scales of pixels of Earth, you know, and trying to understand the larger patterns as these fungal networks stitch together ecosystems.
And they're vast, I mean, spatially. What kind of, and some of these guys are, I mean, they're individuals. These are individual organisms.
You're asking all the hard questions, right? I mean, defining an individual in these fungal networks is incredibly difficult. Because
I mean, they're continuous.
They can be continuous, exactly. They can be continuous for kilometers. The issue is that they have a very different genetic system than humans, let's say, which are quite easy to define genetically. They've got multiple nuclei inside their networks that can be different. So their genomes are not necessarily inside that network, these nuclear contents that are flowing and fill up the spores, which are the reproductive units, are not always exactly the same. So what is an individual if it's not the exact same genetic makeup? For example, you can take two different strains within the same species, grow them together, and sometimes they fuse. They fuse these bridges and they start sharing nuclei. They start sharing resources. Other times you can grow them and they can be a little bit, you know, genetically different. And instead of forming bridges and sharing nutrients, there's conflict. And they start growing and competing to try to get resources to feed to the roots. So I think we're at this point in science right now where we're really trying to understand, what is an individual, and when do you see fusion between individuals, and when do you see that they are competitors? And even that question we don't know yet.
And at your talk at the Arise conference, you were talking about how they behave transactionally. You were talking about how they behave. They behave in certain ways, and they're transactional. And they engage in cost benefit calculations. How that happens? Can you talk a little bit about that? Like they decide, I'm not getting enough nutrients here. I'm going to go there, or I'm going to optimize this at the expense of that.
Yeah, I think we have to be really careful about language here, because obviously these are organisms without cognition, right? But yet they're still able to process information. Plants can process information, fungi can process information, bacteria process information, and we're trying to understand how these fungal networks process information. We know that, for example, they can sense different resource gradients. They can change their growth strategy depending on whether there's high or low nutrients. They change their growth strategy depending on how many different plant partners are available or how many fungal competitors that they're up against. This is all ways that they process information that allows them to evolve strategies that basically optimize those conditions for trade. So we know this because we've developed really high-resolution techniques that allow us to follow these nutrient streams across the fungal network. So what we do is we take resources like phosphorus and we tag them with very, very small particles called quantum dots. And quantum dots actually fluoresce in very bright, pure colors when exposed to UV sources. And we can tag nutrients in different colors. So you can make, let's say, a resource patch that's very high in resources in one color and a resource patch that's very low in resources in a different. And then we can watch.
So for example, like phosphorus here and nitrogen there.
We could do different nutrients. We could also just do phosphorus, let's say a high amount of phosphorus on one side of the network and a low amount of phosphorus on the other, and see how the fungi deal with levels of inequality, right? How do they deal with resource inequality when it's spread across their very complex hyphae? And by doing these types of high-resolution experiments, we see that the fungi are actually very good at taking resources from where they're very readily available and then moving them across the network to places where they're less available and the plant is willing to pay more for them. So where resources are low, they are getting more carbon in return from the plant. And so these are the kinds of experiments that we set up, is trying to understand these strategies. How do they sense where they can make these better trade deals? And you can imagine, these fungi have been under natural selection for hundreds of millions of years. It's not surprising that they would have evolved strategies that allow them to optimize their trading patterns. To me, that seems sort of intuitive that they would be able to sense high and low resource patches and move resources where they're able to get more carbon from it. That's the same way that plants, let's say, would grow towards a light source. So it's not that surprising to me that they're good traders, especially given that they've been engaging in trade for hundreds of millions of years.
You were talking as well about how, a little bit of a fungal hyphal network is growing. There's a lot of nutrients in its established network here, and then suddenly there are fewer nutrients, and so it'll start expanding outwards to exploit other nutrient sources. But it maintains the old network. It doesn't pack up and move. It kind of...
Well, that's a great question, and actually the experiments that we're doing are sort of the first to look at these strategies over time, right? I mean, you have to imagine this has been a black box for decades because this is a symbiosis. So first of all, you have to always have it growing with a plant root. So how do you do that in a soil system? How do you study these strategies in a soil system? And how do you study it over time, right? The time resolution is probably the hardest component of studying this symbiosis, because imagine a fungi might be doing a strategy at one point in time, but 3 days later, it could be doing something totally different. And so that's why these kind of high resolution techniques that allow us to tag nutrients, they allow us to, for the first time, really get a glimpse into how the fungi control the flows of these resources over time.
Show me a video.
Okay, so I'm opening up a video right now of some of the dynamics that we're seeing inside these networks. What surprised people the most is that this is in real time, right? These are videos that are not sped up. This is actually what's happening below our feet. And so it's a very, very fast dynamic movement. And you can see that these flows are going two different directions. And not only are they going two different directions, but sometimes the fungi will change the direction of the overall flow and have it go in a completely different direction. And so really what we're trying to do, you can see now it looks like a living river, but how can a river have so many different dynamics at once, where you can have the river banks flowing in two different directions simultaneously? So those are the kinds of dynamics that we're trying to understand. Let's see, with some of these ones, you can see that they move really, really fast. And then again, different parts of the network are doing different things. And we just don't understand yet how that can all be coordinated by a fungi. So one of the hypotheses that we're just testing right now is how are they calculating what nutrients are where? Where are the high areas of phosphorus? Where are the low areas of phosphorus? And do they use those flows going back and forth and back and forth to actually help them calculate those values? Are they using the flows as a calculator of sorts?
How do you map them?
Okay.
Because you've actually mapped networks in various places, in the Netherlands and elsewhere. Where have you actually mapped networks of mycorrhizal fungi?
So when we talk about mapping mycorrhizal fungi, what we're talking about is mapping the biodiversity patterns. Which fungi are where and what habitats are they associated with? So this project that we have with SPUN is trying to get the first global resolution of these patterns underground. There's been a long history of mycology globally, right? People recognize that fungi, you know, they're different organisms. But a lot of the work so far has really been focused on the mushrooms, the reproductive part of the fungi. The part that stick up, the part we can eat or not eat, these are the mushrooms that have captivated the attention of the public for so long. What we're trying to have people understand is that is just the tip of the iceberg, right? That is the tiniest little ephemeral part of the fungi that comes up briefly and disappears, usually just as fast. But if we were to be able to see underground, we would see a whole different world. It's a world full of these nutrient rivers that are just pulsating with carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen, and they're connecting plant roots. And those are the networks that we're trying to map right now and understand what is the biodiversity, what is the distribution of these fungal networks, and is that changing under climate change? You know, these are ecosystem engineers. I think most people would agree now that if we lost the fungi, the soil would not stick together. It would just start washing away. Fungi are the seam that hold ecosystems together. And yet we don't know who is where. And so we've started this project as the first attempt to get a global picture of where these fungi are. In the next 18 months, we're trying to gather about 10,000 samples. And so it's a massive effort to put these fungi on the map, the way that we have maps of global vegetation or ocean currents, right? These are all systems that we have started to map. Even the stars, we have better maps of than global fungi underground. And this is just key. It's just shocking to me that we haven't developed these maps, considering how important they are for our climate, how important they are for plants and therefore for animals, all surviving above ground, and yet to have no idea of how these networks connect ecosystems across the Earth is shocking to me.
And you said in the beginning, they store vast amounts of carbon.
Exactly. So we're still working on refining these estimates, right? These are very, very hard estimates to get. And, you know, because we're scientists, every number that we say we want to be triple check and double check and check again. And the latest estimates, well, I guess the estimates coming out in the early 2000s were about 5 billion tons of carbon, of CO2, are flowing from plants to underground fungal networks. But that's 5 billion tons of CO2 per year is a huge amount of carbon.
And that's just the flow. I mean, the amount that's actually cumulatively being stored must be orders of magnitude higher than that.
It's very hard to say. I mean, you have to remember that carbon is a cycle. It's a very dynamic process. So a lot of carbon goes below ground, and then the fungi respire carbon. Carbon is also released. And so we're really trying to understand about what is the contribution of mycorrhizal networks to carbon sequestration underground. And that's, you know, that's a big field of study. There's a lot of really innovative scientists that are working on this question. It's a really exciting time to be studying underground fungal networks and their contribution to climate, and asking, you know, what is their role, and what happens if we continue on this trajectory of destroying fungal networks? That's what we're worried about. You know, when you till soil, when you release that carbon from these networks, it can be potentially really dangerous and can lead to tipping points in terms of increases in CO2, and then therefore increasing temperatures and extreme climates. And so we're really advocating for better science that's focused on this underground climate component that has been, I think, really underappreciated in both climate and conservation agendas.
Toby Kears is a professor in the Faculty of Science, Ecology, and Evolution at the Free University of Amsterdam. She's also the founder of something called SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. Listen to Toby at greenplanetmonitor.net and watch a most amazing video of mycorrhizal fungi flowing furiously. You are going with the flow at the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Today, seemingly uninhabitable after 1,000 days of joint U.S.-Israeli genocide, young women and men are writing poetry and publishing their work. In Warsaw, Krakow, and Łódź ghettos under Nazi occupation, concentration camps of Dachau and Buchenwald, and the extermination camps at Auschwitz and Sobibor, Jewish poets wrote poetry too, prose and music as well. Inside Israel USA's Buchenwald on the Mediterranean, poets are organizing themselves. Coastal Lines Press, their poetry collective, is called. 38 writers belong to it at this moment. Their goal, to turn words into life-saving supplies for their families. Last week, we heard Nur Abu Mariam reading two of her poems, Waiting for the Butterfly, and Fear Came to Me Like a Monster, sent to us by WhatsApp. Let's listen to Noor reading them again, then our complete conversation.
Waiting for the butterfly. I know healing is painful, but it's necessary. I try to erase the bad memories, but they return every night before I sleep. And the tear escapes, leaving me in a state no one should have to endure. These hard nights continue. I wake up, put on my clothes, and head to work like a robot. I return home, prepare myself to cry, then sleep, and repeat the same painful routine. I used to escape to the rooftop to breathe in some fresh air, or to draw and write until these words poured out of me. Oh, butterfly, stretch out your wings for me. Open them wide to infinity. Steal me from the roots of my land, but gently. Don't uproot the longing. Leave it behind so I can survive with ease. Let go of this weary country. Haven't you grown tired of sunflowers? Don't you want to try roses and orchids? I want to fly to everything that's new. I open my arms to fly like it's my first time, unaware of what exile means, unfamiliar with longing. Don't bring me back here, lest the causes of death consume me. And here I am, waiting for that butterfly.